Welcome to the World Vision Report. That's a clip from the Oscar-nominated film Ajami. Residents of that Israeli neighborhood say the movie is a realistic portrayal of the violence there.
Sometimes it's about girls, and sometimes it's about more serious matters. But basically at the end, it's not okay, and people get hurt and die.
And an Iraqi child wants to be an artist, but for now, his paintings are all about one thing.
My mother tell me, all wars, just draw one flower, can't you do that? I can't, just war, only tanks and nothing else.
And in Pakistan, an American musician turns humanitarian. Now his hospitals and his music are helping people in remote areas of that country. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
It hit in the middle of the night, 3:34 a.m. local time.
With much of central Chile in ruins, the real push is to speed up
on the streets. Dazed residents huddle together amid the rubble of fallen buildings.
Aftershocks continue to rock Chile, more than 100 of them since last Saturday's major quake. The death toll has risen to more than 800 now. People are still scrambling to get information about missing family and friends. Jen Ross, who lives in Santiago, filed this reporter's notebook about a little girl she's been trying to find near Concepcion, one of the hardest hit areas.
I haven't seen her in 8 years, but I thought of her on Saturday, after picking up the pieces in my home in Chile's capital, Santiago, and comforting my own 2-year-old daughter. Early radio reports announced the area's worst hit by the mammoth earthquake were around the city of Concepcion. I thought back to my first trip there in 2002 to meet Bessie. I've been sponsoring children through World Vision for years. I'm a Chilean Canadian, and by sheer coincidence was assigned a 5-year-old Chilean girl. I lived in Canada then, but traveled to Chile every few years to see my extended family. So I decided to visit Bessie and see the impact of my sponsorship firsthand. I made my way to the Concepcion bus station, and from there to the community of Florida, some 45 minutes from downtown. I knew these were the poorest areas of the country, and it showed. Florida was a putrid-smelling place with stray dogs scrounging for scraps among the rundown houses. Bessie was a thin, shy girl with deep black eyes, sweet and curious about me, as you could expect for a child meeting someone they'd only heard from in letters. Saying her home was modest would be polite. It lacked a toilet, the walls were flimsy, and curtains hung in the place of doors. It felt like a matchbox, not the kind of house likely to withstand an earthquake. I lost touch with Bessie a year after my visit, when her community was deemed self-sufficient, and I was assigned a new sponsored child. Years later, I moved to Chile, but didn't know how to contact her without the sponsorship connection. I've thought of Bessie many times over the years, though. I suppose I could make some calls to find out about her, but I don't want to be a distraction when I know charities are struggling to get help to those in need. And here I am, worried about finding a little girl who touched my heart but who I haven't been able to keep up with over the years. And now I want to reach out to her? I feel guilty for even suggesting it. I don't even remember her last name. How bad is that? I also haven't been able to reach a friend in Concepcion, but I know Carlos lives in decent housing, so his odds of surviving are better. I think back to Bessie's matchbox home and fear the worst. For now, all I can do is hope that somehow I'll get word that she's okay.
Jen Ross is a journalist based in Santiago, Chile. As you just heard, Jen Ross sponsored Bessie through a program run by World Vision, the sponsor of this show. World Vision cares for about 43,000 children in Chile. We asked Lana Rita, who's with World Vision US, how the organization locates its sponsored children after a disaster.
Well, we oftentimes are connected within the communities with a series of partnerships with the local church where present, local schools, local health facilities, and we have staff as well as volunteers that regularly monitor the children and the families. And so we can reach out through this network of whoever is available during the chaos to check on the safety of our sponsored children and other vulnerable children.
And so let's say you do locate a child or family in a community and find out that they are in trouble or that they've been affected by this disaster. Do you contact that child's sponsor?
When we find out that a specific sponsored child has been hurt or injured, or even in some cases, and thankfully it's in rare cases, there was a death, absolutely. We call the donor immediately. We make sure that we convey that information as sensitively but as quickly as possible. And, of course, it's a very much something where we want to honor the dignity and the relationships of everyone involved.
Let's say somebody has a sponsored child in Chile, like our reporter Jen Ross, who just did the story on looking for her former sponsored child and having a hard time locating her. How would someone like Jen go about finding out whether their sponsored child or former sponsored child is okay?
Well, in the case of the child is being currently sponsored, we would have in place staff and volunteers and caregivers that would be using an active network approach toward finding out if that child is doing well. And so we would be able to give an active report, you know, very quickly after a natural disaster. Again, it depends on the level of severity of whether, you know, staff and volunteers can mobilize, but that is their first order of business, is to check on the children. If it's a child that was formally sponsored, we would still mobilize our network to try to find information, but we may not have that specific knowledge of the location.
I understand World Vision has many sponsored children in Haiti. I'm wondering how the response worked with that and how the children fared after that terrible disaster.
Our ADPs, our communities where we serve, are primarily rural. So, in fact, they weren't as hard hit as Port-au-Prince. And, in fact, they became a safe place for many people to exit Port-au-Prince and to go for safety. And, in fact, we take opportunities where we have communities that haven't been impacted that are in proximity of those in need. And we set up something we called a child-friendly space where adults and caregivers can drop off their children, know that they are safe from predators. They will be given opportunities to be fed, to have some counseling needs being addressed. So we work on all different levels, the physical and the emotional, to make sure that children are protected during this chaotic time.
Lana Rita is with World Vision US. Lana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peggy.
Sometimes disasters come out of the blue, like the earthquake in Chile, but sometimes disasters unfold gradually. Take the cluster of small islands off the coast of Panama. Sea levels there are rising, and as a result, entire communities have been flooded. Reporter Sandy Houseman went to the islands and found that 50,000 residents are prepared to abandon their homes, churches, and schools.
The Kuna people are an indigenous tribe who live on a group of small islands off the northeast coast of Panama. They fish these blue waters from dugout canoes, harvest coconuts from palms on white sand beaches, grow fruit, vegetables, and cocoa. There's no television here, no internet, and no indoor plumbing. Wood and thatch homes sit side by side, separated only by narrow, sandy lanes leading to the sea. Each day, someone blows a conch shell to signal the women it's time to sweep the lanes and pick up debris. They emerge from their homes with brooms in hand, dressed in elaborately embroidered blouses and skirts. The men fish in groups, tend their fields, or build houses together. And at night, the community meets with its chief to talk about shared concerns. These days, there's one big fear that dominates the dialogue. Samuel Panisa, who's lived on Black Vulture Island for most of his 63 years, explains.
In November 18, the big waves, all waves, they come up and straight, the all waters come up, big waters. A little house there, it go down. I remember. December 20 is coming again. The big wave again. Maybe they come up again.
Last year, he says, many residents were forced out of their houses by rising tides and high waves. The island's chief, Osvaldo Garcia, had never seen floods like that before.
I was born here, and I have grown old here. This is my home, my community. I work the plantain fields and the coconut trees. I fish, and I find logs for canoes. I have lived off these things all of my life, but this year I've noticed things are changing.
He was alarmed by news that the Caribbean Sea has been rising a little each year for the past decade and that the trend is expected to accelerate. Some scientists think sea levels could rise a total of 2 feet by the end of this century, putting Black Vulture Island underwater.
It's as if the island is sinking. People in Panama say that the ice caps in the north are melting, which is why we notice bigger waves. This is why I've been traveling to Panama, to ask for help.
Chief Garcia believes things are so dire, he's made a radical decision. He wants to relocate his entire community onto the mainland, and he wants the government of Panama to help pay for it.
I asked one of our teachers to help me write letters in Spanish. I took one to Congress, one to the president, one to the Minister of Housing, and one to the Minister of Public Works.
So far, he's heard nothing back. Many young Kunas have already made the trip to Panama City to study or work, but they often return to raise children and to live out their lives surrounded by natural beauty and a familiar way of life. Sipu Galinda, the mother of six, says she'll be sad to leave this land.
This is a good place to live. We're all doing well. Our children like it here. They're happy here. But I've told my children that our island is sinking. If we go to the mainland, I don't know what will happen to us. We can't go over to the mainland without God's help.
Since there's been no response to his letters, Chief Garcia asked the teacher to write one more. He hands it to me.
¿A quién concierne? Estimados señores,
the letter reads, to whom it may concern. The chief asks anyone who can lend a hand to help move his people a few miles away to the mainland to help them rebuild their homes. And he ends by saying, we hope this note is well received in your hands. If the people of this and other islands in the Kuna Nation cannot move together, he knows they'll drift apart, and the close-knit island life they've known for centuries will be washed away. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sandy Houseman on Black Vulture Island, Panama.
Coming up, Oscars, Grammys, and Shorties? Find out more after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Sometimes heroes emerge out of natural disasters, extraordinary men and women who dedicate their lives to rebuilding communities and comforting victims. American musician Todd Shea was so troubled by the images he saw after the massive earthquake in Pakistan 5 years ago that he decided he needed to do something about it. But unlike most volunteers, Todd Shea stayed on. We asked him why.
There's so many reasons. First, the suffering of the children, the injuries that I saw. I hadn't seen any of these other disasters. I also saw a great need where other entities that were doing emergency relief were starting to leave after some time. And because I felt an emotional attachment to the children because of how much injury I saw and how sad that made me, I wanted to do something for them. I also learned that the healthcare system in that area was neglected before the earthquake. And I don't know why, I just took it upon myself that, hey, maybe I can do something with whatever resources I can bring to bear from the states or around the world to keep going here and try to build something that lasts and transcends earthquake relief, helping the children and the people there for decades to come. And then the other part of it is that I think that it's pretty much generally understood now by most people. I think that we left that area after the Soviets were kind of kicked out. We supported Afghanistan and Pakistan in that effort, and then we left. And it's ironic that we rebuilt the countries and societies that were our biggest enemies in World War II, our most hated enemies, so to speak, Japan and Germany, yet our friends in Pakistan, we didn't help them. So as an American citizen, I feel a responsibility.
And we should tell listeners that you actually started a nonprofit charity hospital called Comprehensive Disaster Relief Services, or CDRS. How does an individual do that?
Well, I think that as time went by and I did get my act together, I had the ability to do some things. And that led me through these disasters and gaining more confidence that by the time Pakistan had come, I realized that there were some things that needed to be done here, and I felt I had the ability to do to them. Now, I don't treat patients. I wouldn't even treat a hangnail. My doctors do that. And they're doctors that are local, but they were assessed by doctors from around the world that are some of the greatest in their field. So I had that backing me up. And as long as I keep them going with funds and logistics and take care of their needs so that they have more time to be doctors and do what they're trained to do, then it's not rocket science. You know, it takes more love and compassion, sweat and ability than being brilliant to do this, I think.
So you built a hospital. It's in a rural area.
12 facilities. What I've done is gone into areas where the government is reestablishing facilities that were destroyed in the earthquake. And sometimes we rent a house. Sometimes we use a building that withstood the earthquake because it was built better than others. And sometimes another donor has built a building and we run the insides of it. In other words, we tend to utilize what's there, even if it's a home, even if it's a shack. It's better to have a shack with great medicines and doctors than the other way around.
So what you've done is you've started a hospital, but you've gone in and rebuilt 12 medical centers that were already there but needed a lot of staffing and medicine and help. How have you done that? Have you done that on your own?
No, I mean, it's a team. I'm kind of at the center of the storm, but there's a great many Pakistani-American doctors who worked with me all through the acute phase of the emergency and since then, and medical students and others who have come and they've seen the work we're doing on the ground and how we spend our money on the right things. We rent local Jeeps. We live amongst the community. We become part of the community. And the people that we work with that have come and volunteer see that. And they go back and tell their families and friends and set up little fundraisers or get-togethers. And they've supported us. And that's how we've kept going. But we've seen over 300,000 patients in the last 3.5 years. At $1.75 per patient contact is what it's worked out to be after you look at the little under $500,000 that we've collected and spent. So we're highly effective. And the people on the ground love us because we actually do what we say we're going to do. We're willing to fill the gaps in the system in the high and very remote areas. But as long as we go into the community and even rent a house and provide those medical facilities, those doctors and those medicines, then you can take care of a lot of the primary health care and emergency health care needs that the people suffer from.
And I take it there's great demand for this kind of medical care in the remote areas in Pakistan.
Well, we average about 10,000 patients a month. And now we're in the areas just below Swat, and we have medical teams there working to help the people, which is an overwhelming situation over there. So there is tremendous need.
You must be quite a novelty for many of the Pakistani people you meet, especially in rural areas where they may never have met an American. What do they think of you?
You know, some people in the beginning, they were a little bit mistrustful, but then they saw that we were really there to help. So we kind of won them in that way. And word has gotten around about me that I'm doing a good job and I'm there sincerely trying to help them. And so I'm very well received. And people there are amazingly hospitable and have a lot of love to give. Some poor people that hardly have anything when you're going through their village, they want you to stop and have tea. And if that's all they have, then that's what they want to give you. And it's really quite humbling.
Did you take your guitar along?
Oh, yeah. I play for the kids. I've learned some songs in Urdu. And, you know, I'm not that great of a singer-songwriter. I've done okay for myself. But they just like it to hear a white guy singing some songs in their language. It is a novelty, but they really enjoy it. It brings smiles to their faces. And the music brings us closer together.
And did you bring your guitar today in the studio?
Yes.
Any chance you could play for us one of the most popular songs that the kids enjoy over there?
Sure. There's a song called Dil Dil Pakistan. It's kind of an unofficial anthem for Pakistan. and I'd be happy to play it for you.
Garapnato subco jijana se Pierra luktahe, Pierra luktahe. Humco be upne har armana se Pierra luktahe, Pierra luktahe. Dil, dil, Pakistan, John, John, Pakistan. Dil, dil, Pakistan.
The song Dil Dil Pakistan was originally performed back in 1987 by the Pakistani band Vital Signs. When the BBC did a global poll a few years ago to find the top 10 most popular songs of all time, Dil Dil Pakistan came in at number 3. Oscar time, and once again, the Academy Awards will honor the best foreign language film produced outside the U.S. One of the nominees is an Israeli film about a rough-and-tumble neighborhood in the city of Jaffa. Daniel Estrin reports.
A teenager sits by the side of the road, chatting with a girl as he fixes his neighbor's car. Suddenly, two men on a motorcycle drive by. The teen is killed in the drive-by shooting. But he's the wrong guy. The killers are after the owner of the car, revenge for a shooting in their family. This is the opening scene of Ajami, the Oscar-nominated Israeli movie named after the tough neighborhood where it was filmed. Ajami sits in South Jaffa, a city populated by Christians, Muslims, and Jews. The film is fictional, but when Hussein Chakra, who grew up near Ajami, saw that opening scene, it was like a flashback to his own childhood.
It's exactly what happened to me when I was young. I was on that same street when I was visiting my grandfather. I was outside on the balcony.
He saw a car round the corner and the window rolled down. A hand holding a gun extended from the car and shot two people on the street.
They just started shooting at them and I believe killed them and drove by very fast.
Chakra says the violence was unavoidable.
Sometimes it's about girls, and sometimes it's about more serious matters. It depends. But basically at the end, it's not okay, and people get hurt and die. And that's why now I'm not living in Jaffa, and I'm not going back to live in Jaffa anytime soon.
The streets of Ajami feature a jumble of crumbling cement buildings, but also mansions with peeling exteriors. They offer a glimpse of this Mediterranean city's former glory. During Israel's War of Independence, Arab residents here who had the means fled the city. Today, much of the city is marked by poverty, crime, family feuds, school dropouts, and clashes between Jewish police and Arab residents. At the entrance to the Ajami neighborhood, two officers pull over cars and ask to see drivers' IDs. Police here say they're fighting crime, but Arab residents say the police single them out based on their ethnicity. Those frictions are the undercurrent of the film's multi-layered plot, one that includes an Arab man who deals drugs to pay off a debt, and a Jewish policeman whose brother goes missing in the West Bank. The film exposes the ugly underbelly of Jaffa. But most people here say that's a good thing. Noel Rihan is one of them. The 25-year-old hopes the film will hold up a mirror for people living here and encourage them to start expecting more from their children.
لا ضروري ضروري ان حدا من الكبار من الناس اللي عن جد بيقدروا يعملوا.
We must watch this film once, twice, three times, she says. And then we have to do something to change our situation. Otherwise, another generation will marry and have kids and will act the same way as their parents did. Ajami's cinematography is raw, quick-paced, documentary style. But that's not the only reason the action in the film seems so real. Most of the actors aren't professional. They're Jaffa residents who play, in a sense, themselves. The actors playing policemen have all served as officers in the area. And the residents have experienced the violence depicted in the film firsthand. In this scene, a mother who has lost one son in gang-related violence screams at her other son who's returning home. Where were you? She wails, knowing that he could be next. Nisreen Siksik plays the role of the mother.
Before we filmed the scene, the directors took me into a room and reminded me of what happened in my life, the killing, and I started to cry. I cried a lot.
In real life, a gang tried multiple times to kill Siksik's husband so he wouldn't testify in a murder trial. Siksik lived in fear for years, and finally, 5 years ago, they shot and killed him. So for the scene with the actor who plays her son, Siksik didn't have a script. Instead, the directors, a Jewish-Arab duo, just reminded her of events in her own life, and the cameras started rolling.
When my son came home, I was angry, and I hit him. The actor was in shock. The directors were in shock. They said,
amazing. Ajami is now being taught in an Israeli film school, and Siksik hopes it will encourage the country's future filmmakers to continue shining a spotlight on the darker spots of Israeli society. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin in the Jaffa neighborhood of Ajami, Israel.
The Oscars aren't the only awards being handed out this season. Here's our Globe at a Glance. The Shorty Awards were announced a few days ago. The Shorties are like the Oscars of the Grammys, except they're for Twitter. They honor the best tweets. Twitter made a big impact during the earthquake in Haiti when survivors used it to communicate with the outside world. Images of the devastation were transmitted around the globe by Twitter. And the Nielsen Company, the same one that does TV ratings, says that Twitter has been the leading source of discussion about what's happening in Haiti. Many aid organizations are paying attention. Now they're using Twitter to solicit donations after disasters like the recent earthquake in Chile. And as for the awards, nominations were made by, you guessed it, sending a tweet. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. Now we turn our attention to an award-winning film about an extraordinary group of women in Liberia. They lived through the civil war there and risked their lives to stand up to brutal warlords and a corrupt government. The filmmakers have captured the inspirational story of the women in a documentary called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. Rachel Clift reviewed the film.
If Pray the Devil Back to Hell never made it to a theater near you, be sure to add it to your Netflix list, because this is a film you do not want to miss. In this inspirational documentary, we meet the Liberian women, Christians and Muslims alike, who stood up against violent warlords and a brutal government to pave the way for peace. The filmmakers make excellent use of archival footage, taking us back to Liberia in 2003, when a bloody civil war is ravaging the country. Child soldiers flash their guns at the camera. Villagers flee to the capital, Monrovia, where they're forced to live in overcrowded refugee camps. Those who don't escape are killed by rebels waging a senseless battle against then-President Charles Taylor, himself a former warlord. Social worker Lema Bowie describes the profound anxiety of a nation in conflict.
It was always like you go to bed and pray that you have something different the next day. You know, that the shooting will stop, that the killing will stop, that the hunger will stop, saying, God, please.
The story of the peace movement, from its birth inside a Monrovian church to its army of women 1,000 strong, is told exclusively through the voices of those who stood at the front lines. And it is Lema Bowie who emerges as the central character. She plays the role of de facto general, leading her army, clad in their signature white t-shirts, through the streets of Monrovia while rebel forces descend upon the capital city.
Thousands of women, including IDPs, internally displaced persons, went. It was the first time in our history in Liberia where Muslim women and Christian women were coming together.
Vaba Flomo, president of the Christian Women's Peace Initiative, describes the team as fearless.
We were not afraid. And we said, well, if I should get killed, just remember me that I was fighting for peace.
Time and again, filmmakers Jeannie Redeker and Abigail Disney highlight the protesters' remarkable political savvy at every turn in their courageous journey. These women may sing and dance for peace, but they are also visionary leaders who refuse to back down until the job is done. For instance, in the lead-up to the film's unforgettable climax, Lema Bowie organizes a human barricade around the compound in Ghana, where peace talks between President Taylor and the rebel factions have come to a complete standstill.
So I told the women, sit at the door and loop arms, one arm within the other. And the next thing we heard on the overhead speaker was, oh my God, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, the Peace Hall has been seized by General Lema and her troops.
The footage of this event is woven together so seamlessly with the interviews that you feel as if you're watching the drama unfold in real time. It's a nonfiction narrative suspenseful enough to rival Hollywood's most exciting big-budget features. But Pray the Devil Back to Hell is much more than the story of good versus evil. For policymakers, the film offers new ways to think about the role women can play in peace-building. For grassroots leaders, it's a blueprint for success. And for ordinary people who continue to suffer from the devastating effects of war, it may provide hope, or perhaps a call to action. Look at us, say the women of Liberia. We did it. So can you.
Rachel Clift is a writer and award-winning documentary producer. She lives in Brooklyn. Coming up, an Iraqi child draws his way through the trauma of war. That's just ahead. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Iraq is holding its second parliamentary election since the U.S. invasion, and that's a good thing. But the violence continues in that country, including a recent string of suicide bombings. 10-year-old Osama is an Iraqi refugee who's seen his share of violence in Iraq. Reporter Will Everett met the boy on a trip to Damascus, and he sent us this reporter's notebook.
My name is Osama Ahmad. I'm 10 years old.
The first thing I noticed about Osama was that he was a really happy kid, a smiling boy with enormous brown eyes. He'd learned a little English from playing computer games and was eager to talk to a foreigner.
I've learned English by not books, but I've learned it by computers. So like that, I've started at a little 3 words or four. Then I've end by 100 words or more.
He especially liked playing American war games, but preferred strategy games to those with lots of bombs and bloodshed. His family had left Iraq when Osama was 6 because of the growing sectarian violence in their part of Baghdad. What Osama remembered most was the initial invasion. When I asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said he once wanted to be an army officer, but he'd recently had a change of heart.
When I grow up, I start to think by be a general, then I change my mind to be an artist.
Painting was Osama's passion. His mother said that he comes home every day and loses himself in his paints. The family lives in a part of town inhabited by a lot of poor refugee families. I'd encountered some of their kids in the street, and they seemed wild and restless. I thought it was great that Osama had something constructive to do with his free time. And then he brought out his pictures.
Look, this is my paint. Look.
Oh, I see.
This is a game. It was like a hill and soldiers want to get to
the other. As he flipped through the spiral notebook, I studied the scenes of carnage and destruction. The violence that he shied away from in his computer games had found expression in his art. Page after page showed crude helicopters dropping bombs on burning houses while people ran in terror, or bodies crushed under tanks.
My art is all wars. My mother tell me, all wars, just draw one flower. Can't you do that? I can't. Just war, war, war. Only tanks and nothing else. I don't know what.
He wasn't trying to make a political statement or make the American guest uneasy. He simply drew what was on his mind, the images that had haunted him from early childhood and begged for expression.
This is a war by the Americans, hammers, fast bullets, and this is have a bombs in the air and they explode. It was a terrible thing.
Why do you want to draw pictures of terrible things?
Well, I don't know. This is all what I know. I draw pictures. I don't know why.
His mom didn't know either. The strange thing was he didn't seem haunted or damaged. He had a purpose in life, to be a painter, which was a lot more than could be said of the refugee kids I saw who loitered in alleys smoking cigarettes. When I went to find a taxi, they followed me, seeing a foreigner in their midst. They shouted epithets in Arabic and circled me like a pack of dogs. They were scary. But perhaps they were expressing the same buried trauma as Osama, but without the tools that he had at his disposal. As the taxi left and they receded from view, I thought, would a pen or a paintbrush make any difference to those kids? Then again, would it make any difference to Osama? Would it always be war, war, war? Or would he one day pick up his brush and paint the flower that his mother has wanted from him for so long?
Soldiers want to get to the other side.
Will Everett is a freelance journalist based in Texas.
I don't know what to call in English, but she's very hurt. And this one is the final battle of the humanity and the robotics.
Julia Nagahu has a dangerous job in a dangerous city. She's a taxi driver in Nairobi, Kenya, a city so rife with crime, the locals call it Nairobbery. Nagahu got into the taxi business reluctantly a few years ago. She's one of a handful of women daring enough to take on the job. Reporter Sonia Varma buckled up next to Nagahu to see how she steers clear of trouble while making a living on Nairobi's mean streets.
Thousands of taxis navigate Nairobi's chaotic streets. Julia Nagahu's black Toyota is one of them. As she pushes through downtown traffic, Nagahu issues a warning to her customer, who's unfamiliar with the city.
At night, don't try walking there.
Nagahu passes a street sign that cautions drivers about carjackings. A few feet later, another billboard reads, "Beware the human dog. This is a rape hotspot. You are likely to be raped here." You might think this sign marks a dark alley, but the warnings are scattered around Nairobi's downtown, a signal that these are dangerous streets. But Nagahu doesn't need reminding. She says almost every month she hears of an attack on a taxi driver.
As I'm talking today, yesterday somebody was taken and we still is not known where he is. The car was found, but he cannot be seen. That was yesterday.
46-year-old Nagahu is a rare breed in the business. There are fewer than 10 women driving taxis in all of Nairobi. Most Kenyan men wouldn't want their wife or girlfriend driving a taxi, especially when a rape reportedly occurs here every 30 seconds. But Nagahu has no husband to tell her no or to rely on.
This is very dangerous, but I just don't want to clothe myself in fear and then not able to pay my bills, not able to have food. So you take risk, you take chances. Life goes on.
Nagahu never imagined she'd be shuttling tourists and business people from place to place for a living. As a child, she dreamed of being a doctor. But her parents put no value on educating girls. She did manage to get a good job with a Catholic charity. After 12 years and a promotion, she'd saved enough to open up her own business. So, 7 years ago, Nagahu moved back to her home province and set up a corner store. Then, 3 years ago, her luck took a bad turn.
I got sick, very sick in the year 2002, which I had 3 operations in 3 months. And that cost my business, my savings, and everything else I had.
Nagahu, a divorcee, was left with a small house and car. With little education, she saw only 2 options. Sell the car for some money, or use the car to make some.
By the way, this Bong Hills, you have ever seen the Out of Africa movie?
Out of Africa, yeah.
Yes, those are the hills you see.
Driving eco-tourists around is one thing, but early on in the job, Nagahu saw the seedy side of driving a taxi. Nagahu soon learned that many of her colleagues cater to clients of Nairobi's sex trade, but she steers clear of it. Instead, Nagahu pays for a spot at Kenya's international airport. She lines up there at 5 a.m. along with 700 other taxis jockeying for business.
There are also camping sites there. Such places.
Nagahu drops off a family of tourists at Nairobi's famous carnivore restaurant. She wanted more for herself in life, but her lack of education held her back.
I usually say it's not like there was no money. There was no will. Although I did insist that I wanted to get education. I was good in school. I would not claim to be a genius, but if I went to books, I come out with something. I never failed my primary school education, which I worked for it myself. I started working when I was 6 years old in people's farms. This is not very easy for me.
The memory of the lost opportunity still brings her to tears.
Hello. Tikolu defarae. Nikinyuma na denakoya. Okay.
Customer?
Yes, customer. He's telling me to pick him at 6.
In recent months, Nagahu's managed to build up a sizable and fairly regular client base. With the airport and her private customers, she's able to pull in over $1,000 a month. Nagahu calls it survival money, because there's not much left over after she pays for gas and other expenses, and she's trying to save for a new car. Nagahu admits it's not an easy way to make a living. There are always slow times and rude customers, but there are also busy days and big tippers.
Sometimes you feel encouraged, sometimes you feel very discouraged, but I believe in going on and fighting on. That I believe.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Sonia Varma in Nairobi, Kenya.
Her band goes by the name Zap Mama. Her name is Marie Daoun. Daoun was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the 1960s. And even though she spent most of her life in Belgium, her African roots are evident in her music. Our guide to global music, Ish Mafundukwa, joins us for more about Marie Daoun and her band Zap Mama. Ish, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Peggy.
One of the really interesting things about the lead singer of Zap Mama is her personal life story. Can you tell us a little bit about her childhood?
She was born in the 60s in the Congo, and when she was just a few weeks old, her parents were forced to escape from their home because as a mixed couple, the rebels who were agitating for independence in the Congo didn't like mixed marriages. So her mother hid her with some pygmies. She was only a few weeks old, and their father was killed. And eventually they got airlifted or whatever to Belgium, which was the colonial power in the Belgian Congo. It was called the Belgian Congo then. And that's where she grew up. But growing up, she always said that she heard her mother singing the songs from back home and from the Congo.
What a story to be hidden in the jungle with the pygmies. What were they like and what was their music like?
Well, they sing what is called polyphonic type of singing. You get many voice parts, but everybody's doing their own thing. The melodies are different. Pretty basic in the sense that they use their voices more than anything else. They don't use any sophisticated instruments.
How did this influence Marie's music?
Well, what actually happened is she was only for a few weeks with the pygmies in the jungle when she was still an infant. And then she went off to Belgium. And then she went back on her own when she turned 18 and went to the jungle and stayed with the pygmies for a while. And while listening to their music and learning how they did this polyphonic type of singing, she was very fascinated by it.
Let's go ahead and listen to one of these songs. I think one of the titles that represents this well would be Nabombeli Yo.
Nabombeli Yo. It's a very good example of that, yes.
Nabombeli Yo, namatema nangai ha. 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 Nabombeli Yo, namatema nangai ha.
Well, that is really interesting. What's happening there? Is that mostly her voice, or are there a lot of other voices woven in?
There was five of them at the very beginning, and those are the other women that were in the band with her. But basically, Zap Mama is Marie. It's her thing. It's her project.
And then how is what we just heard similar to what we would hear from the pygmies in the jungles of the Congo?
It's similar in the sense that, you know, these people will gather in an opening in the jungle and just start singing. And everybody, it's like everybody's doing their own thing. Everybody, it's like different songs together, but it all comes out as one.
Marie talks about her voice being the most powerful instrument, and she does a lot of a cappella music.
Yes, I mean, when I saw Marie just after the release of their very first album, which was called Zap Mama in Europe, she said to me, people rely on technology so much that they've forgotten the beauty of the human voice. That album just illustrates the power and the beauty of the voice. And one track that really illustrates that is called Kuzopela.
That's beautiful. What does Kuzopela mean?
Kuzopela is Zulu for "it shall end." And this song is about apartheid, because this album was released before the death of apartheid in South Africa.
Now, Marie Daoun released an album a couple of years ago called Supermoon, and it really reflects her change and her shift toward not more global music, but more contemporary to reach a broader audience. Tell us a little about this latest album.
From the third album, they started doing more fusion and more collaborations with other artists. We're not necessarily doing voice, but, you know, they started incorporating instruments into their music, doing collaborations with a huge variety of people, I think. She actually moved to the United States in 2000 and stayed there for, I think, 3 or 4 years.
What song would you suggest we play to illustrate her new sound?
The track that really does it for me on Supermoon is Gati.
That really is a different sound.
I think what she's been attempting to do is, like you said, to reach a wider audience. And by collaborating with all these people like the rappers, Erykah Badu, and I think, you know, trying to get her foot in the door, if you will, in the United States. This is the whole idea. I think it's a very, it's a commercial move that they made to try to reach a wider audience.
I think you like her earlier music better than her latest music.
Yeah, I certainly like the earlier music better because it's just so pure. I'm not being a purist here, you know. But, you know, compared to what they're doing now, I prefer the earlier stuff because it's just the beauty of the human voice, and she does it so well.
Ish Mafundukwa is our guide to global music. He spoke to us from Zimbabwe. And we'll leave you today with more music from Zap Mama. Remember, you can download a podcast of the show on iTunes or at our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also read blogs from our reporters around the world. And you can post your comments. We're always interested in feedback about the show. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Our engineering assistant is Emily Eagle. Our production assistant is Chris Baldiga. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us again next week.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.
I dream to be a queen.